It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Tim McKenzie-Smith. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Stuart. How are you doing?
We're here to talk about your debut feature, a documentary called Getting It Back, The Story of Sumunde. We're also going to cover three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. But before we get into that, let's talk about the documentary. And before I get into any details about the process of making it, just want to give the listener a brief synopsis to what the documentary is about.
Yeah, so it's called Getting It Back, The Story of Sumunde. It's about a long-lost British band from the 70s who played a mixture of funk, calypso, soul, and everything in between, who did three amazing albums in the 70s, but no one in the UK really gave a shit about them, quite honestly. But they found success in the States. They were the first British band to play the Apollo. They toured with Al Green and they were playing to massive audiences and their tunes were getting in the top 20 in the R&B charts and they were really making a splash. But every time they came home, they could barely get a gig in a pub and they got no support from any of the institutions of British life. And they decided to quit and to take a break because they were so sort of beaten down by the process. And they all went on to do very different disparate jobs. Two of them became lawyers, one became an electrician, and a few of them stayed in the music business. But while they were doing their own thing, the music went on a journey of its own. It was taken up in the very early days of hip-hop and disco. Some of their tracks were like core documents in the history of the development of these two genres, these nascent genres. And they then became one of the most sampled British bands of all time because the kids whose parents bought the records in the 70s in New York started raiding their parents' record collection for breaks. And they found these three albums with all sorts of amazing things on them, proper treasure trove of breaks and samples and all sorts of things. And the music just took on this amazing life of its own and ultimately over a period of 40 years went through the generations, went through the genres to the point where it, you know, kids were picking it up on Spotify and YouTube and the algorithm was telling them to listen to this band. And eventually the band realized this and realized that they had an audience out there that they had no idea existed. So they came back. They made their comeback in 2014 and I was there at the gig at Coco, which was a beautiful experience and quite interesting. I felt like I was one of the oldest people there because all these kids were there. It was an amazing young audience, all appreciating this music. And I then thought, you know, a few years later that this was a story that should be out there and I wanted to be the one to tell it.
I felt like it was my own little petri dish of how I found them because I literally didn't know about them till your documentary. And what's weird about that is I had Electro 4, 5, and 6. My first gig I ever went to was the Bigger and Deffer tour, LL Cool J. So I was in the 80s, I was into hip hop and electro and stuff. And then even sort of house music. I mean, Stu Allen on Piccadilly Radio in Manchester, you had Beat This, which was like the hip hop hour, and you had the house hour. I used to stay up till 12 o'clock, set my tape going at 12, and then go to sleep because it was a Sunday night show. so I could get 45 minutes of house music in sort of 87 or something. And I had no, this name never crossed my path at all. And it's weird then when you see a documentary and see all these people who I've listened to, who it was a key thing. And I mean, and there's a great quote in your film, which I mean, you must've been over the moon when I think it's Vincent Mason says, you know, if it hadn't been for songs like What Samantha Were Doing, there'd be no hip hop. I mean, that's phenomenal for a band that were largely, were unnoticed until, like you said, like the way that the internet spreads music, that it began to sort of pick up its own infamy, I suppose, as this foundation of two big columns of dance music.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting for me as coming to it as a fan. I knew this. What were kind of interested me were the questions of initially, you know, for me it was where did they go and why don't more people know them? Because you know, as a fan of the music, I picked it up on a mixtape in the 90s, and it was a mixtape where I didn't have a track list on there. It was going around my uni. It's just called Rare Groove, and everyone was copying it and passing it on, you know. And there were two Samando tracks on there, which I didn't know was Samando at the time. And they were two of my favorite tracks on the album. But I just thought they were an American funk band, you know, at the time, because they were two of their more kind of funky tunes. And so I then found out about 5 years later who they actually were, because I had a really good mate of mine who was a record collector. And he had their records, and he was playing me Samando and telling me about this band. They're from South London. We were living in Streatham at the time. And then I heard these tunes that I've been listening to for years, and who they were by. And I was like, oh my God, it's them, you know? And that kind of set me down a path of kind of always having in my mind, well, more people should know about this. Why don't more people know about the fact that we've got this amazing British funk band that, you know, as I then learned more, I realized just how deep the sampling went and started to understand more of the story, you know. And so as always, that was the question for me, was, you know, what happened to them? Yeah, it was only in the making of the film where I got to really understand the all the other elements that were in play, just how influential they were, and just the kind of sheer depth of people like me that were out there, you know. Because also you go into the process and you're not necessarily sure who within those genres is going to be willing to talk to you, how enthusiastic they're really going to be. You're projecting and hoping that they're going to be as enthusiastic about them as you are, but you don't really know until you're in a room with them. I mean, you know, you get an inkling, because I came from sport documentaries, really, sort of before doing this one. A lot of the time when you're doing interviews for sport documentaries, the people that you're interviewing, it feels like, you know, they're doing it with a gun to their head, because they don't want to they're just trotting out stuff that they've said a million times, or they don't want to be talking about this subject. They're not interested in it, but you're paying them. You know what I mean? Whereas this, it was proper enthusiasm in the room, and it was two people who were fans of something basically fanboying about it for an hour. So it was wonderful in that regard, you know. And the way I conducted the interviews was quite loose and relaxed, because I wanted to be very present and be really listening. Do you know what I mean? Because I didn't know what they were going to say. You know, there were certain beats you always want to hit in an interview for a documentary, but ultimately the key is that you're listening, and if they're going in directions that you didn't know existed, you have to be present enough to jump on that and then go down that road and explore it, you know? And that's where the kind of magic comes, I think, you know? So the interviews we got with some incredible names, it was a pretty joyous thing for me, just as a fanboy of not only Samando, but mainly these people as well that I was interviewing, you know, like Maceo from De La Soul. I mean, come on, like Norman Jay. I mean, ridiculous. Norman Jay probably had more influence on my musical knowledge than any other human, you know, and I'm sat in a room in Brixton, the Prince of Wales, just chatting to him about music for an hour. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that, you know.
Exactly. Now, given you've said it was like there was a journey of discovery making the film, I mean, often when I speak to people who have done documentaries, there's a perception of what I'm going to do, and then there's the change of perception through doing a documentary. So I'm guessing by the sounds of things, you had a lot of those moments as your understanding of their importance began to evolve. So what for you is like your fondest sort of discovery about Simone that is in the film, then for you sort of justified why you were on this journey to make the film?
Well, I mean, there's so many really, but I mean, the most important discovery, I think, in terms of how the film turned out and the importance to me of the story that is wider than just the music was really the understanding I got from the band just about what life was like for them in growing up in the UK. And, you know, them as representatives of the black community in the UK, you know, in the 50s, 60s and 70s and all the obstacles that they faced. You know, I was slightly concerned about projecting something like that from my position as someone who hadn't lived that experience, you know. And I was writing a treatment for it because in the early days of doing this work, I thought maybe I might be able to get someone to fund it. I thought, well, I'm going to write a treatment and do a trailer and stuff. So I was writing this treatment. And when I got to this certain point of the context and the realities of the black experience in the UK, yeah. I felt like I couldn't write the words because I hadn't done any interviews with the guys yet. And I just felt like there was something holding me back because I didn't feel it was my place to write this yet. No, and it's almost like I needed, not permission is probably the wrong word, but I needed sort of them to unlock the door and let me walk through it, if you see what I mean.
Well, I guess that they give you the authority, because I know what you mean, because in a treatment, you've got to sell what the potential drama is of the documentary you're going to make.
Yeah.
But predicting that in a treatment feels a bit...
Exactly.
Too presumptuous, whereas if you're talking to them about it, it gives you an authority, doesn't it?
So I basically emailed Stephen Patrick, the two founder members of the band, and just kind of said, look, you know, it'd be really great if you could give me some background on the reality of your experiences growing up and as a band, you know, and the obstacles that were put in your way by the institutions of British life.
Yeah.
And they sent me this incredible document. It was, you know, a Word document. It was probably sort of 7-8 pages long. And it laid everything out and it became kind of like the blueprint for us to go down those avenues in terms of the context and the historical side of it, which is really important to me because it is an important story of life in Britain at the time and the experience of young black people and the obstacles that they faced.
Yeah.
So once I had that, I felt like I'd almost... I gave myself permission to go down those avenues without any kind of concerns of that regard, you know. So that was a really important moment, getting that from the guys. And then on the other side with the music, it was the sheer joy of getting to film it, you know. Firstly, filming with the band, and then once we captured things on camera, we just knew that we had some potential magic here. And then it was a case of, well, you know, if this film isn't good, then the only person whose fault it is mine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The raw materials are definitely there. Now it's up to me to make sure I don't mess it up.
I mean, you're right. There's a sort of the black experience of America between just across a decade. Moved so much because I guess early 70s and what you show with some of your archive footage is there's still a kind, well, I mean, not that it's gone completely, but there's a strong know your place and we can just get rid of you when we don't want you anymore, as opposed to this is your home, welcome and be part of what Britain is, you know, whereas you move forward to the end of the 70s and you've got, and again, these are not massive leaks, but they would have been, I suppose, in comparison to the early 70s, Laurie Cunningham playing for England at football, you know, the first black footballer to put the England shirt on, you know, these were, but that was 6 or 7 years after the first album come out. So it's a timely reminder in some senses as to how unwelcoming and how vile and grim it was, the level of, you know, outward racism.
Music and the institutions of British culture were just representative of life in general across the spectrum, you know. There's a sequence that due to time and everything, we were gutted that we had to cut out of the film, which is Stephen, Patrick and Sam talking about their experiences at school. You know, it was a miserable experience as a young black kid who come over from the Caribbean to go to a British school, you know, for myriad reasons. And, you know, so music and the institutions of cultural life that ignored the band were just indicative of the country as a whole. You know, people who came from the Caribbean were invited over as British citizens.
They had British passports.
They had British passports, exactly. And then when they got here, the way they were treated was ridiculous and horrible. And they had to, you know, really rally around in the community in order to survive in many ways. So it's a really important part of the story, you know, for me, you know, and it makes it more, I think, than I hope anyway, more than just a standard music documentary, because, you know, a lot of music documentaries and sport documentaries and any documentaries that have a kind of historical bent, you know, they always have sort of pay lip service to the context. You know, if there's a documentary about a band in the 80s, you're always going to see shots of the miners' strikes and Thatcher and all of that. You know, if it's in the 90s, you know, you're going to see Blair, you know, Diana, all that kind of stuff. But it's only just to kind of go, this was the era, this was what was going on at the time. But it doesn't really play into the actual story. Whereas this, it was an important part of why the band split, you know, ultimately, because they weren't given the support that they really deserved, you know. Like when they were touring America and playing, you know, stadiums, 30,000 people, playing the Apollo, if they were any other band, like a white band, they would have, as soon as they got back, they would have got an old grey whistle test.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, why were they not on old grey whistle test when they just toured the States and they're in the top 20? Like, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So, yeah, the context had played a huge role, and learning that was an important part of the journey for me, for sure.
Yeah, and to sort of complete that arc, the idea that then, I think it's late 80s, Ruthless Rap Assassin, isn't it, when they do their rap using Simone's music to tell a story of the Windrush.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they were the next generation. You know, they were talking, and they were talking about their parents. You know, they were talking about the sadnesses in the lives of their parents and how things had panned out over here. You know, and so they were carrying the story on. You know, from a slightly different perspective as kids who were born in the UK. You know, the guys in Simone weren't born in the UK. They all came over at varying ages as kids.
Yeah.
So they can remember what life was like before they came over here, before they came into the smog and the freezing weather and the general greyness of 50s and 60s Britain, you know. They can remember what life was like in the Caribbean. So whereas the Ruthless Rap Assassins, they were born and raised here, but the problem still remained, you know.
Yeah.
Again, when we interviewed those guys in Manchester, and there's an extended version of that chapter in the Blu-ray that we're releasing. They talked about their experiences in a similar vein, you know, the racism that they endured and the problems that they faced. Also, them as a band, you know, there's a similar thing there. They were very ahead of their time, weren't supported in the way they should have been, because, you know, they were turning out some brilliant British rap music, but no one was interested, you know. So, yeah, the story continued, basically.
So when you've got such a big story to tell, which literally straddles from when they arrive in Britain to when they're reforming and playing these gigs in the present day, what for you represented the main storytelling challenges pulling that together into a 90-minute movie?
It's just balance, you know, like trying to balance everything. When you've got so many different story strands, you know, do you know how far do you go with one at the expense of another? And you've got six core characters that you want to make sure that people understand who they are and what they've done. You've got all the different musical elements, all the different genres and the different generations of people who kept the story going. And obviously the context. So it was, it was all about trying to balance those elements. And also you're trying to appeal to not only to people who know them, but also to people who don't know them. So you had to balance that out and not get too deep into the kind of nerdiness of it that you know might appeal to me, but also appeal to people who don't know them. You don't want to alienate half your audience. So balance is the key word. Just trying to balancing all those elements to try and create a narrative that works, but also, you know, is not favoring one group of people over another.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I guess I would fit into that audience, in that half of the audience that didn't know about them, because it definitely felt like to me you sort of gave us the real context as to what gave us the band in the first place. And then I love the way that you kept batting, almost like there was like this parallel timeline, the way you're telling it, which is the band's music becoming big in America and then slowly becoming part of dance music culture over there, while at the same time they knew they couldn't go on. But then I felt like, this is, I didn't know what it was building to because obviously I've not seen it before, but I felt we were building to some crescendo, and I was so glad that it was, and they pick their tools back up again and they are playing live to audiences that are more than half their age now.
Yeah, I mean, we always knew that you know, part, it's almost like the music becomes the protagonist in the second act, you know, but also you have to make sure that you're not just sidelining the band for half an hour. You've got to make sure that you're seeing what they're doing, and it's like these two stories are running in parallel. You've got the music story taking on a life of its own, and you've got the band members' stories of what they were doing at that time, and then it comes together as the music and the characters connect again, you know, and then it becomes one story again. And it was that was something that was really important to us. We felt we needed to separate the music and the band for that kind of era where the guys are in the wilderness, you know. And to the point where we had to do something that pained us massively in the edit. Because when I the first shoot I did with the band, I got the guys in this rehearsal room in Acton to break down Bra for me, which is my favorite song ever, and has the famous bass break that is so widely sampled by, you know, hundreds of people over the years. And I got them just to kind of break it down for me and explain it and talk it and do it. And I was like, my God, this is so amazing. I can't wait for this. This is going to be one of the best bits in the film. But the problem was that Bra was the centerpiece of a huge sequence that was happening where the band weren't there. And this wasn't the kind of film where you're like, you're deeply analyzing the way the music was made, you know, like kind of classic albums or something like that. You know, Bra is a story point, you know, because it's the song that represents the birth of the Renaissance in New York. So we cut that sequence where you've got loads of DJs playing it and talking about it, you know, around the birth of hip hop. And we were trying to incorporate this brilliant, brilliant, brilliant sequence of the guys doing stuff with it in the rehearsal room. But it wasn't working, because we just knew that we just needed them to be separate, because narratively, you know, the audience need to understand that the band and the music are two different things now.
Yeah.
You know, so let's take it out. And we were absolutely gutted, gutted to take it out. But we knew we had to, you know, it had to be done.
So what's happening with the Blu-ray then, and what have you managed to pack that with on top of the film?
So the Blu-ray's out on the 26th of February.
Okay.
And it's got some brilliant extras in it. It's got that sequence.
I was hoping you were going to say.
Yeah. It's so that was the key thing. Like when they said, so what else are you going to put on it? That was number one. It's also got an extended version of Jazzy J, legendary Zulu Nation DJ and all round awesome dude, basically in his basement doing a Samande mix, which he did for me on a Sunday in Brooklyn. And I'll tell you the story of this. It was the weirdest thing. So we did a shoot with him on the Friday, and Stephen Patrick went to meet him, and he was absolutely, it blew his mind so much. He couldn't believe that they were in his house. To the point where the Saturday he came into our hotel because he was really annoyed that he forgot to get the guys to sign his records. So I brought his records in for the guys to sign on the Saturday. And then on the Sunday, I had a day off. So my cameraman, David Caulfield, the DOP, he said to me, look, you just have a day off, relax, go and meet your mate. I had a mate who lived in Brooklyn, also called Dave. I'm gonna just go around getting like detail shots around New York. I don't need you for that, you know, you just go and chill. So I was on basically a bar crawl in Brooklyn, and my phone goes, and it's Jazzy J, and he's like going, Tim, you got to come to the house, man. I'm like, why? What's going on? He goes, I was up all night, and I've come up with a Samando mix. You've got to come and film it. And I was like, damn straight, I've got to come and film it. But I was half cut at the time. And I was like, so I called my cameraman, Dave, up, and I was like, mate, we've got to go back to Jazzy J's house. Where are you? He goes, oh, I'm up in Harlem. I said, right, get down to Brooklyn now. So we went to Brooklyn, back to Jazzy J's house. And I was just sat there on the sofa, having had a fair few beers on my day off, just kind of sitting there wide-eyed going, I can't believe this is happening. I'm in Jazzy J's basement and he's doing a Samando mix. So that was one of the great moments of the experience of making the film. And there's an extended version of that in the extras. There's also, as I said, the Ruthless Rap Assassins extended feature, which goes into loads more detail about their experiences up in the UK, which is great. And, you know, again, it had to be cut for time just because ultimately it's not about them.
Yeah.
It's a story that's worth telling and worth listening to, you know.
No, I interviewed the guys behind the Scala documentary, and, you know, they had similar challenges, you know, to keep it into sort of a 90-minute format when you've got so many stories to tell around.
It's hard, you know. It's hard, like, you know, the first...
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Cut's always pretty unwieldy. And the funny thing with the first cut is that you've been spending 6 months on it and you're kind of trying to kid yourself that, oh, it'd be fine if it's 150, won't it? No, it'd be fine, you know. It's just got so much in it. I couldn't lose any of it, you know. And then you send it out to people who you respect and just to kind of get an objective viewpoint on it. And you say to them, just tell me, don't tell me what you like about it. Tell me what you don't like about it. Tell me what's wrong with it. And, you know, they're always like, too long. And so you kind of know that, yes, it is too long and I am being too beholden to things that I know in my soul need to go, but I'm just clinging on to them just a little bit too long because I love them so much, you know. But the Blu-ray extra element has been a joy for that because it's given us the opportunity to, you know, keep these bits in a different way.
Brilliant. Well, look, Getting It Back, the story of Samando, is going to be available on Blu-ray from the 26th of February. It is fantastic, and I think like we've discussed, it balances beautifully the idea of this incendiary music as part of a bigger music scene of hip hop and disco, and also one of the arguably kind of the best kept secrets of British music you've revealed, and also a horrendous story of a reminder of institutional racism that may be the reason why they are a secret up until recently, in a sense. So congratulations on bringing all that to light.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
I should ask, was there anything else did we cover everything is there anything obvious that you didn't say or cover that you'd like to cover before we go into the three films?
I mean, the only thing that we haven't covered in terms of the making of it is just how fucking hard it is to make a fucking documentary. Like, over 6 years, when people are telling you, no, it's a bit niche, I'm not sure, you know, and you're going, no, there is a story here we believe it needs to be told. And you have to just go through the fire to make it, you know, when everyone's telling you, don't be so stupid. But that's the only thing we didn't cover.
Well then, moving swiftly into three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. And for the listener that's come along to hear you talk about your film, I'll just briefly go over the sort of basic rules, and they're simple. You've given me three movies, and I'm going to give you 5 minutes to talk about what that lasting memory is of those movies. It's against the clock. So every time we hear this noise, you can hear that at your end, okay?
Yeah.
Every time we hear that noise, that's the time for us to stop talking about that film and move on to the next one. That sound fair enough?
Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant. Right, clock's ticking. And the first of your choices is Muhammad Ali, When We Were Kings, Leon Gast's documentary from 1996. Do you want to talk about where that fits in your film life?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's probably quite an obvious thing for a documentary maker to do, because it was like the origin story for a lot of people, I think, you know, my generation anyway, to understand just what a documentary or cinema documentary could be. I watched it in Brisbane while I was traveling in 1997. And we watched it because I was thinking about Muhammad Ali, brilliant, you know, yeah, we've got nothing on this afternoon. And I was with my mate Chappers, as I was traveling with, and you know, we just didn't have massive expectations. We just thought it'd probably be quite a good watch, and came out just going, that's one of the greatest things I've ever seen. And I suddenly had an appreciation of what documentary could be. You know, it appealed to everything that I loved. You know, I was a huge boxing fan back in the 80s. I obviously wasn't old enough to have seen Muhammad Ali and George Foreman fight. Yeah. But I'd obviously saw all of the and you know, everyone knew Muhammad Ali at that point. He was, you know, an icon. And it just blew my mind. And the fact that there was also this incredible gig there that James Brown was playing, and loads of other brilliant artists, like I think B.B. King and people like that. And the heavyweight talking heads they had were just ridiculous. It was like Norman Mailer and Spike Lee and people like this. And you were just like, this is like unbelievable cultural moment. And, you know, it was footage that was kind of in boxes for 20 odd years.
Yeah.
And so you felt like you were witnessing something new, even though it was old. It wasn't just a documentary that, you know, a lot of documentaries, the holy grail of all documentaries is archive that people haven't seen.
Yeah.
You know, and this was a problem for our documentary because there was no archive of the band. This leads me to just go on one quick tangent, because I have to, because it's a great little story, of the only bit of archive of Samande. So we're talking about the complete opposite of When We Were Kings. There was no big box of tapes of Samande. When I started the documentary, I was hoping there was going to be some footage of the band, but no, there wasn't, which is a bit of a struggle when you're doing a documentary, I'll tell you. But there was one bit of footage, and the band thought it was for German TV, right? Mm-hmm. They had a tape. It was the early iteration of a VHS. You know, it wasn't the VHS that we knew and loved in the 80s, but it was that the very early iteration of that.
Right.
So they filmed it in a club in London, and they thought it was going on German TV. But I had to find out who owned it to clear it, because I've used their tape, you know. Mm-hmm. We had an archive producer who went all over Germany asking people about it. And everyone in Germany was like, what the hell are you talking about? This is nothing to do with us. So I then went on the most ridiculous detective dig, where I found out that the production company that made it, who later became one of the early sort of home ordering VHS kind of horror movie people, they're called Intervision. They made this because I ascertained that basically what they did was that they filmed people in clubs for the clubs. So they do basically, they create what a TV show, a fake TV show essentially, that they would then, they would license the show and give the equipment to the club so that they could get around licensing laws. So they could claim it as live entertainment and stay open later.
Oh, wow.
But my lawyer was like, well, I was like, look, this company folded in like 1981. And my lawyer was like, yeah, but you still need to get someone's permission. And I was like, well, I can't find any evidence that any of them still exist. You know, this was, we're talking 50 years ago. So I went on this insane detective thing, spree or something. I don't know what you want to call it, but trying to find someone who was still alive from Intervision to give us permission to use it. And I tracked down the only person I could track down. Is now a fly fishing tackle salesman in Tasmania. Took me a week to find him. And he was like, oh, yeah, yeah, that was us. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's fine, you know. And it was such a relief to get the permission. But, yeah, bizarre. So I ended up learning about, you know, people in the early days of video nasties, and the culture of getting around licensing laws in order to stay open later.
Perfect timing. I have to ask, I mean, the one question I wanted to ask you was, is there any direct influence of When We Were Kings in Samande that you're conscious you made as a decision?
No, I don't think... It's funny, when we were making the film, I barely watched any documentaries for the last 6-7 years, because we didn't want to feel like we were ripping anything off. We just wanted to try and tell the story the right way as we saw it, you know.
Right.
Obviously, a lot of people compare it in some ways to Searching for Sugar Man in terms of the kind of story of an artist who was long since forgotten who came back, you know. Yeah. And I watched Searching for Sugar Man when it came out and absolutely loved it. But Matt, my producer and editing partner, he had never seen it. And people kept saying to him, oh, you should watch Searching for Sugar Man. And he was like, I am not watching for Searching for Sugar Man until we're finished, because I do not want to feel, even if it's subconscious, that in some way it's influenced my thinking as an editor, you know. When We Were Kings, I can't think of any specific influences, you know. Like, you just got to try and tell the story as best you can.
Yeah.
You got to serve that particular story, you know. And if you try and sort of think, well, someone else did it that way, so we should do that, it's just you're then kind of thinking along the wrong lines, I think.
Got you. Right then. Film number two is Get Shorty from 1995, directed by the Coen brothers, cinematographer of their first three films, Barry Sonnenfeld,
right,
and adapted for film by Scott Frank.
This is not the most obvious one, but, you know, I did love it when it came out. It's a really funny, offbeat tale of a lone shark who moves to Hollywood and gets involved in the movie industry. Great satire, like great piece of satire immediately there, you know, thinking of a lone shark moving to Hollywood and immediately thinking, oh, man, I should work in the movie business because there's so many sharks in there already. And an amazing cast, John Travolta basking in the afterglow of, his Pulp Fiction rebirth.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Gene Hackman there, Dennis Farina, who is one of my favorite ever character actors, who also is in probably what is my favorite ever film, Midnight Run.
Mm.
Absolutely adore that film and watch that film probably more than any other. But the reason I bring this one up is not because of the merits of the film, it's because I picked the book up while I was traveling. Again, I always seem to end up going back to when I'm traveling. It's a really formative, important part of my life. I was in Australia in a bookshop in Byron Bay, and I picked the book up, and I was like, oh, I'm not sure I even realized that this was based on a book.
Okay.
And so I picked the book up. It was by Elmore Leonard,
mm-hmm.
who I read the book, and the book was absolutely brilliant. And the dialogue that he wrote was just absolutely awesome. And I just suddenly had to just hoover up all of his books. You know, I became a bit of an Elmore Leonard obsessive. And when I was a couple of years later, I was trying to work out what I wanted to do with my life. I knew I wanted to do something creative, and so I took a punt on a postgraduate course just called Writing and Production for the Media.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the modules on there was copywriting. And one of the assignments we had was to write a blurb for a book. And so I decided to choose Get Shorty just because it was a book I loved. And part of it was like, you've got to try and write in the voice of the author, you know.
Mm.
And I thought that might be quite fun to try and write in the voice of Elmore Leonard, you know, kind of hard-boiled but with a twist of humor, you know. So I did it, and the tutor said, "Oh, this is really good. You know, my mate works at Penguin. I'm going to send it to her, see what she thinks." And I was like, "Oh, okay, cool." And then she came back and said, "This is really good. By the way, Elmore Leonard's doing a sequel to Get Shorty right now, which we're about to publish. Do you want to have a stab at doing the blurb for it, the cover copy, as it was called?" I was like, "Oh yeah, why not? That'd be great, you know." So I did it, and they used it. And so my blurb was on the back of the sequel, Be Cool.
Fantastic.
And then I spent the next, like, probably 6 months, because they were reissuing all of his books, spent the 6 months just knocking out blurbs for about 10, 15 Elmore Leonard books, you know, getting the books, reading them in a, you know, I'd read half of them already, so reading them in half a day to a day, and then knocking a blurb out, getting paid £53
to do it.
Yeah. But it was brilliant. And what it taught me, and the way it relates to what I'm doing now, it taught me that I could edit.
Yeah.
Because essentially you're boiling a book down into probably 65 words. And also in these particular ones, you had to get a pull quote out, the kind of key quote that sums the book up. And that was something I felt I could do. And that's what I've ended up doing, because essentially editing words and editing pictures is the same thing. Writing is editing. Editing is writing. It's all the same thing. Ultimately, you're trying to boil something down to its essence and tell the story in whatever format you're doing it, whether it's in 60 words or 90-minute film or you know, a 90-page script. Whatever. Essentially, the question is always, well, what's the story? What's the story I'm telling here? You know, don't veer from the story. What is it that you're trying to say? So it kind of gave that gave me kind of the confidence to kind of go, do you know what? I probably can do something in this field, you know? So let's give it a try.
No, I totally agree. I mean, it's pulling together pitch decks and creating log lines for films and film ideas is about economy, not about prose.
100%. And, you know, like doing the film, you know, what people say is, you
finish
know,
your
we
thought.
Need, what's that?
Say, finish your thought. The alarm was just going off then. Finish your thought.
Oh, the bell's gone. Oh, sorry. No, like, you know, they say, can we have a synopsis? Can we have a log line? All of this stuff, you know? And so, bringing those tools to bear, it's the same thing. You know, you're trying to sell something in as few words as possible. I'm basically repeating what you just said, but in a lamer way.
but I think but just for people listening who are not too aware, it's a process that takes time though. It might only be 60 words, but you can take a day sometimes.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah. You know, it's easy. It's like editing a film takes a year.
Yeah.
It always ends up getting to the point where you think, well, it should always just have been like this. Of course it's going to end up like this. But the avenues of pain and horror that you get to that point that seems so simple and seems so obvious afterwards is ridiculous. And it's the same with writing. You know, you're smashing your head against the wall until suddenly it's what it always should have been. And you're like, well, why can't I just do that first? Why have I got to go through all of these drafts and all these versions to get to the point that it's really obvious that this needed to get to?
Well, just referring to Scott Frank, who wrote the film Get Shorty, I mean, even though he's such a celebrated screenwriter, he still fears the front, the blank page, because he knows he has to go through that process. But you don't know when you start whether you'll get to the other end, you know, because
you've got to put one foot in front of the other and just do it, you know. And it's the same with editing a film, especially a documentary where you've shot hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of footage with multiple people on multiple subjects that you could go in 8,000 different directions with it. When you first start, you know, and you've just got all these rushes and you're like, okay, where first then? You know,
God,
but you just got to believe in the process. You've got to start going through the material, log it, start putting it into bins where you're just working out, well, this would work in this theme. This is a good character bit here, you know, and you just got to break it down into stuff that's manageable, because if you start projecting too far forward, you go mad. You know, it's like, okay, what do I do today to push it forward that's not going to break my brain?
Absolutely. Right then, sir, your final choice rushes us forward into the 21st century to 2006. Directed by Martin Scorsese, I'm talking about The Departed, the reworking of Alan Mack and Felix Chung's Hong Kong action thriller Infernal Affairs. Not an obvious Scorsese choice, but tell us where it fits in with you.
Okay, so it's not an obvious Scorsese choice, you're right. It's not the greatest Scorsese film. I still love it. It's got some great things.
I love it too.
It's a great adaptation of Infernal Affairs. And despite the fact that Matt, my editor, has refused to watch it because he thinks it's a disgrace that anyone would adapt to Infernal Affairs, one of the greatest films ever, in his opinion. So he refuses to watch it. But the reason I do it is twofold, really. One, Scorsese was the guy that kind of opened my eyes to many elements of cinema. You know, I became obsessed with him in the early 90s. Probably it was because of Goodfellas, but I then went back and watched Mean Streets and Taxi Driver and The King of Comedy and The Color of Money, which I suspect I'd already seen and loved, but didn't really know it was him, because he was kind of working as a gun for hire on that. But I did my dissertation on Scorsese. I was just obsessed with the guy, and he was my first cinematic love. But the reason I tell it is because the other love of my life, who I'm still with, Sarah, I met her traveling, again, going back to traveling in 97. But we were mates. We didn't get together until 2006, when she moved back from Australia. And I kind of knew that it was on the cards and it was going to happen, but I was terrified of messing it up because we were really good friends. And even though she knew too, and she was, you know, just patiently waiting for me to stop being an idiot. But I was terrified of messing up something that she was one of my best mates, and I didn't want to fuck it up, basically. But we went to see The Departed. And it's, you know, it's not the most obvious date movie, but
not
we
at
went
all,
to
no.
see it. And for some reason, I don't know whether it was the intoxicating effects of Jack Nicholson being crazy, or Ray Winston's strange Boston accent, or you know, the Scorsese 12th use of Gimme Shelter. But that, for some reason, for some magical reason, that was the night that we did get together.
Fantastic.
So, you know, the combination of my cinematic love and my true love. There you go.
Fantastic. So when you ran a dissertation about Martin Scorsese, what did you focus on?
It was the outsider, the protagonist, you know, the outsider in his films, because obviously he was a real outsider for most of his life because he had asthma. So he couldn't, in his early days, you know, the reason he got to go into movies was because he couldn't play sports. He couldn't do anything physical because he had such bad asthma.
Right.
And so I kind of felt like that was part of him always. And he always seemed to make choices where the main character was an outsider in some degree.
Yeah.
You know, the obvious ones is the ultimate outsider, Travis Bickle. But Rupert Pupkin in The King of Comedy as well, you know, the true outsider who is determined to show that he's worth something when he, you know, he probably isn't, you know. But it always felt to me that Henry Hill as well in Goodfellas, even though he's part of the crew as a half Irish guy, he's never going to truly be part of it. He's always going to be on the outside looking a little bit. He's never going to be a made guy. So that was what I was kind of going for. Well, I must admit, I haven't read it for 20 years, and I'm sure it's absolute rubbish.
I had the French director on, J.K. Amelou, who did a film called Hard Men in 96, which kind of predates sort of Lockstock. It was like one of the first sort of British gangster movies that sort of broke out. And he told me, you know, he was like, when he ever got in a black cab, you know, they'd want to talk about it. And he managed to get some work developing some stuff or working with Scorsese. And he gets to Scorsese's place and there's a stack of screenplays like just on a table. And JK said, I joke, and he just said, you know, you're behind with your reading. And he goes, no. He says, they're all the projects I want to do that nobody will fund, kind of thing.
Yeah, wow.
And you think, Scorsese's got that problem. Jeez, what the...
Yeah, I mean, thing is, you know, it's really interesting. His career is so interesting in that regard because, you know, he doesn't make choices that are necessarily going to be big money spinners, you know. And he went through the wilderness years in the 80s where people weren't going to see his films and you know, he felt like, you know, there was a chance that his career might be over, you know, and he did do, you know, Color of Money. He did that as a Gun for Hire and did it so brilliantly, you know, that I think people sort of, I think that's probably one of the only ones where he's kind of done it just almost not coming from him. It came from somewhere else. And he said, yeah, I'll do that, you know? Mm. So he went through the wilderness and he, even now, you know, as someone who's got probably the greatest career in American cinema, the fact that, you know, he's got projects that people won't commit to, it's incredible. You know, if I was someone with a lot of money at a studio, if he comes to me with anything, I'm commissioning it immediately.
Yeah.
You know? But it's a business, isn't it, ultimately?
Of course, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He has now got to the point where, you know, with the vagaries of streaming, you know, and the money that Netflix and Apple have, they obviously have seen the value to them of having someone like him on their being associated with their brand. So he's managed to get loads of money out of them to do films that really, you know, are quite thematically dense and powerful and not obvious cinema fillers, you know.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So they're going, well, we'll give it a little cinema run, and then it's going to be on our platform, and then we're associated with Martin Scorsese. So in a weird way, even especially as like the foremost exponent of cinema as an art form and watching movies as an important part of life, it's quite interesting that they kind of jumped on the Scorsese bandwagon, you know, for completely different reasons. But ultimately, the kind of battle you have is that, well, yeah, but these films wouldn't be made if they didn't. Killers of the Flower Moon would not be made if Apple hadn't come in and given him 200 million quid to do it, you know?
Absolutely.
So you can kind of go, well, it's that classic, the battle between art and commerce in making films is just one that, you know, everyone's affected by, even him, you know?
Indeed. Well, look, thank you for sharing those stories with the three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. And thank you for sharing the stories around getting it back, the story of Samande.
No worries.
That's okay. Well, we'll remind people that's out on Blu-ray from the 26th of February. I totally recommend it. I can't wait to see some of those extras. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Thanks, mate. No, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
credit card rewards, greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.